The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, FA Cup. It's the greatest upset since the last time they played each other. Extended condom riff ahoy. City put their old fella in a hoodie. Prophylactics route back to Wembley glory. And Wigan duly get a semi in the bag. Was it tactics? Was it tempo? Or was the big issue the fact that Pellegrini looked like he was selling one? We ran up all the cup news from Bramall Lane to the Emirates and get the latest from the league too. Chelsea beating up on Spurs players. Spurs manager beating up on Spurs players. And Fulham, is there anyone left for them to fire? There's news from the continent too as we count down to another cracking round of Champions League games. There's posts, tweets and more in this Football Weekly. Hi everybody, what a weekend. Lovely weather, lovely Wigan win. And lovely Owen Gibson joining us today.
It gladdens the heart, doesn't it?
Yeah. James Horncastle's also here.
Yeah, that's me.
And as is Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Top show ahead of us then. We've got John Ashton, I think, on the line very shortly to talk about the excitement of Sheffield United from the third tier of English football being in a Wembley semi-final. But we've got to start with the extraordinary fence at the Etihad as Wigan once again defeated Man City. Man City, who at home had been awesome, Chelsea accepted, just destroying all comers. Turns out all you had to do is play three centre-halves.
Exactly. And rely on Pellegrini to make a couple of changes and rely on Manchester City to play particularly badly in the first half.
All right. And Di Michaelis as well.
Di Michaelis, why? Pellegrini's hoodie, why?
Right, okay. Yeah. Wait, the hoodie thing's been all over the papers and that, but do you think there is a serious point to be made there that they were just taking things too casual?
I do. I think there was an element of complacency. Pellegrini effectively said so afterwards, didn't he? That particularly in that first half, they looked as though they were half asleep still. And De Michelis sort of was the exemplar of a lot of that casualness, even though he has played appallingly, really, in key games throughout the season.
It's not a new thing, is it?
No.
I think the only blessing in that respect is he's suspended for their second leg against Barca. So, you know, that's a blessing in disguise, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he got sent off in the first game against Barcelona and had a bit of a nightmare against Chelsea. So, a lot of people asking, what is the continued attraction that he holds for Pellegrini? You got any explanation there, Barry?
No.
Okay.
I think Xavi was talking about this in another paper at the weekend, wasn't he? Where he said that Pellegrini likes his ability to play out from the back.
Ah.
You know, given he gives you so little else.
And keeps making game-changing errors, you would think that, you know, I can only imagine it's because he knows him well and he trusts him, although that trust doesn't seem to be being rewarded.
Indeed not. But let's talk about Wigan and how great they were. Uwe Rosler coming in. We talked a little bit before the game about the great run of results that he's had there. And what a performance in this one.
Well, as Michael Cox pointed out in his tactics breakdown of the game, Uwe Rosler had said before the game that, you know, he was just concentrating on his own team and not paying much attention to City, but that clearly wasn't the case because he lined his team out with three centre-backs, which is unusual. And, they had to rely on a bit of luck, especially towards the end of the game when they were sort of, it was very much backs to the wall stuff, but you could be forgiven for thinking if you hadn't seen the game that maybe they'd just sat back, defended deep, and that really wasn't the case.
Not the case.
Very good,
at all.
But as Owen has already said, City were pretty poor as well, you know, which helped.
But those are interesting afterwards, as he said, he sort of studied those two games last season, hadn't he, including the FA Cup final win, obviously, and based his tactics on that accordingly.
Had Pellegrini not studied the FA Cup?
Clearly not, no.
Right.
Maybe he should have done.
Okay. Well, it was an absolutely huge shock. When the draw was made before this game took off in the new fangled FA manner, everyone assumed, oh, well, that's Arsenal's chances gone. They'd beaten Everton in a fine display, certainly in the second half, the previous day. Everyone assumed they were going to be playing Man City, but now they get Wigan in the semi-final and then either Hull or Sunderland in the final.
If they beat Wigan in the semi-final.
If they beat
Wigan in the semi-final. I didn't make that clear. I've done it again, haven't I?
Yes.
I've made assumptions.
Yes.
Birmingham City, won't they? What happened against Birmingham City, Owen?
Well, obviously they got beat in the final of the League Cup against Birmingham City when everybody thought Arsene Wenger was finally going to get the monkey off his back and they were going to win a Wembley final.
Monkey's still very much in place.
Arsenal are notorious for choking in finals, you know. So if they get past Wigan, in their past they've been beaten by Cardiff City, Swindon, West Ham in 1980, Luton 1988,
Barcelona,
Real Zaragoza in 1995, Birmingham 2011. Mm. So they have a proud history of big final chokes against teams they're very much expected to beat.
I think perhaps some pressure might fall on Arsenal's shoulders given how this has become a monkey on their backs. Whereas for Wigan, I think they'll probably enjoy playing at Wembley, you know, have the experience of last year. Mm. And the way that they played, as Barry mentioned, play three at the back. Not many teams do that in the Premier League. I think it's unconventional. They'll make things awkward for their opponents. Again, some praise for Uwe Rosler, because I remember going to an FA Cup tie last year where he took Chelsea to a replay. He's always been someone who's played...
That was with Brentford.
Brentford, yeah. He's always been someone who's played sort of expansive football, even with limited resources, players of limited talent. And I think, yeah, it's a credit to him, really, that he's been able to push boundaries at whatever club he's been at. And I think... We'll probably see that in the semi as well.
I was just going to say, though, on Arsenal, it's interesting that, you know, they did show some fight on Saturday. It's not the classic Arsenal sort of spring choking story. You know, kind of Ertzil looks as though he's back on form. Wenger was very complimentary about him afterwards, about his work rate and so on. Giroud, you know, back scoring goals. Maybe he's now being forgiven for being photographed in his pants in various tabloids. And, you know, you just think it's not, they're not falling away. It's not, you know, when they started to wobble a bit, you expected them to do what they usually do around this time of the year. And that's clearly not quite the case. So it'll be interesting to see if they can regroup.
Absolutely. Stirring finish to that game at the Emirates. Let's now, though, speak to John Ashdown, who was at Bramall Lane for one of the other big stories in this Cup weekend. Sheffield United defeat of Charlton Athletic. John Ashdown!
Hello there.
Hey, John. You're live from Yorkshire. What do you got to say for yourself?
Well, I'm very, very happy Yorkshire at the moment.
Right. What was the atmosphere like?
Everybody's buzzing.
Yeah, were they? Yeah. At Bramall Lane, how was it? A 2-0 win, eh?
Yeah, it was fantastic. There was over 30,000 people there, which is pretty good going for a League One club. It was a fairly slow start from both teams, which quite often happens in these early kickoffs. Nobody really got going, and then second half United sort of steps it up a bit, and Charlton couldn't really respond, and there was two goals in the space of about a minute and a half, and that was enough to take us to Wembley.
Wow. Where you are in with the chance of becoming, am I right in saying, the first third tier team ever in the final?
Is that right? I didn't know that stat.
I don't know. Nobody else seems to be nodding, so I might have made that up. But it'd be great if it was true.
Well, I think Chesterfield should have done it years ago, but they were robbed in their semi-final against Middlesbrough.
Old line technology then, eh?
1995.
Right. Mm.
But with certainly the first third-tier team since 2001 to reach the semi-finals.
Well, there you go. That's already something.
John, despite Sheffield United being a division below Charlton, this wasn't really much of an upset, was it? Because they're in such a good run of form and they were at home with a huge support. Did it come as a big surprise to you that you won the game?
It was pretty confident going into it. We'd won eight on the bounce before Sunday. And I think it was sort of the fact that it was such a good draw for United was overshadowed by the fact that we were looking at a Steel City derby at one point, and then Wednesday clearly slightly bottled it against Charlton in their game, and so it ended up being the two lowest ranked teams left in the competition, one of which was banging form, which was us, and one of which was really struggling, which was Charlton. And Charlton, to be fair, looked like a League One team in waiting, I thought, for quite a long time. They really struggled. I think if they'd turned up in a league fixture at Bramall Lane this season, they really wouldn't have looked too much out of place. So it wasn't a started as bookies favourites as well, but whenever you, as a United fan, whenever you're sort of feeling confident, that makes you slightly worried, and you're expecting disappointment. But for once, they turned up, which is great.
Good stuff, John. Who do you want in the final?
Well, at the moment, we feel like we can take on anybody, I think. Yeah, but I think I tell you what, we would take Wigan, I think, probably, and we'd give Arsenal a game as well. But no, it's just gonna be a great day out. We've never, as far as I know, we've never scored at the new Wembley in three attempts, I think it is now. So, and the last time we went there, obviously, was the final 2 years ago when Huddersfield and United drew 0-0 after 120 dreadful minutes. And then it went to a penalty shootout, and Simonson, our goalkeeper, whacked one over the bar to send Huddersfield up. So there's a few bad memories that we could do with rectifying, I think.
Right, a quick note on Wigan. Producer Ben pointing out they didn't just field three centre-halves, they also had four Macs in midfield. Those Macs in full, McCann, McEachran, McManaman, and MacArthur. And then they brought on James McLean just to finally...
And they sold McCarthy to Everton, didn't they?
Right. That's the thing. That's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, return of the Macs.
Return. Yeah, they to the Macs. Yeah. Yeah, anyway, we'll move on. Hull, we've got the two sides of the Hull-Sunderland axis here. It was very much Hull over there with you, James Horncastle, and Sunderland, Barry. I suspect you might not both be too displeased with what happened in that game.
I'm not particularly bothered that Sunderland lost. They've more important things to worry about, but the manner of the defeat was pretty awful. And having done so well in the Capital One Cup final last week, Gus Poyet made some bewildering selections, and a lot of them let him down.
What kind of thing?
Well, he'd Andre De Sena in at left back, and he had a shocker. I don't think he offers much in that position at all, and he wasn't very good. Stephen Fletcher started instead of the very much informed Fabio Barini, which didn't make much sense. And Lee Catamol, he had a sort of curate's egg of a game. He was very impressive for a while, and then he got booked for a foul on David Myler. David Myler and various other Hull players waved imaginary cards at the referee, which I don't particularly like to see.
Continentals.
Yeah, fancy Dan Continental, David Myler. And Catamol was booked and sort of retreated into his shell then, because he was obviously a concern that he might be sent off for another tackle. Mm. And then the errors for some of the goals were just awful. Mm. Won a comedy back pass from him as well.
Sunderland, in the meantime, with other pressing concerns, as you hint, they are now second last in the Premier League, but with three games in hand and just 1 point from safety. From Hull's point of view, what did you think, James?
Yeah, really positive. I mean, it's the first trip to Wembley since they went up in the playoffs 6 years ago. And it's their first FA Cup semi-final since 1930. Yeah, it's a competition that Hull, for a long time, haven't done particularly well in. You know, they've reached this stage, the quarter-final stage, and that's been a glass ceiling for them. So, yeah, and I think Steve Bruce has done a great job this season, all considered. You know, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy around Hull with the name change. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's let that affect the squad. I don't think it's particularly been a galvanising force either. I just think they've got on with it. And to be honest, I think the business that they did in January with regard to their Premier League status, Jelovic and Long has been good. Both of those players didn't play, obviously, in the cup tie because they were ineligible. But they still found a way to win. And interestingly, yeah, Sunderland, a former club of his, Sheffield United, a former club of his. If he gets to the final, it's Wigan, a former club of his.
Or in the Stars.
Yeah. So
even though Steve Bruce whipped up the excitement afterwards by saying the FA Cup has, for me, lost a bit of its magic. but he said, but it does get exciting now when he gets to this stage. So maybe
why was that? Did he?
I think he was just looking back to his Manchester United days and passing comment on the competition as a whole. Interesting thing to say after storming through to the semi-final.
Another bit of the old traditional magic's gone, apparently, with the loss of Budweiser as a sponsor.
I know, sad day for all the romantics out there. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, well.
What have they pulled the plug?
I don't know. They've come to the end of their deal and they've decided not to renew.
Any word on the big question of who will be replacing them?
No, not as yet.
Okay.
So it's be the FA Cup with a big question mark.
Yeah. Mm. Your name here, FA Cup.
It's a curious comment to make, though, from Bruce, isn't it? Considering how Wigan won it last year, Hull in the semi-final, Sheffield United in the semi-final, Wigan in the semi-final again.
Mm.
You know, we've gone about this magic of the cup, you know, no longer being there, and yet both cup competitions, the League Cup and the FA Cup in recent years, have played up to that narrative, haven't
they? Everyone likes the magic of the cup, don't they, until two non-top four teams reach the final, and then all of a sudden they become, oh, this is dreadful. No one's taking the cup seriously anymore, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's enough on the cup, frankly. It's lost its appeal for me too. Let's move on to Champions League right after this. Right, Champions League. Now, let's start once again with Man City, because they've blown the FA Cup. Not sure how you'd regard their situation in the Premier League, where they are 9 points behind, with the games in hand, of course, but still 9 points behind Chelsea. And as for the Champions League, well, of course, they're 2-0 down, and those are two away goals, against Barcelona. Now, they're going to be at the Camp Nou, the new camp, this week, where Barcelona are not in the best of form. Indeed, they're just coming off their third loss in their last six games in the league. It was away to Valladolid. And Sid Lowe joins us, of course, on the line now to tell us... Oh, hello, Barry.
I'm just going to say, I don't know why Sid's bothered to be on the line, because he couldn't be bothered to go to this game.
Yes, Sid. How about that, Sid?
We're completely rambled.
You missed
rambled.
The news.
Yeah, completely rambled. Every weekend, certainly if you do a whole country as I do, you have to kind of make a gamble on where you think the story is going to be and which thing you're going to really focus on. And football has a habit of making you look like a bit of an idiot. So I chose not to go to Valladolid, which is a relatively reachable ground from Madrid. It's only a couple of hours away. So I thought, well, you know, Barcelona are not playing very well, but the chances are this will be a game with very little story to it. And obviously watch it on the telly. But Barcelona, as you said, lost their third game in six. And it's been treated as if they've just lost the league title. And to be honest with you, I think they probably have just lost the league title. Not just because of the situation it puts them in, 4 points behind Real Madrid with 11 games to go, but because of the way the two teams are playing, because when you look at the fixture list, it's very, very hard to see a way in which Barcelona could pull that back. Now, obviously, lots of people say, well, it's not that hard to see it, because in only 2 weeks, they play Real Madrid at the Bernabeu, and of course, winning that, they'd only be 1 point behind, and then things feel rather different. But first of all, right now, the way they're playing, you don't expect them to win at the Bernabeu, and they were awful on Saturday, really, really bad. And also, you look at the trajectory, it's not just about that weekend, and Barcelona have now allowed a six-point lead to be turned into a four-point deficit, and for those who are not very good at maths like me, I think that's 10-point swing.
It's 10-point swing, isn't it? Well, so is there a bit of a feeling of a kind of end of an era? A lot of talk that Xavi, for example, is going to be moving to the MLS after the World Cup.
Well, I think it's inevitable that there's some talk of end of an era, because bear in mind that, you know, you're talking about a Barcelona side that obviously Pep Guardiola has already gone, Peter Villanova has already gone, that Victor Valdés, and bear in mind that there are three captains at Barcelona, Valdés, Xavi, and Puyol. At the end of the season, Valdés is going. Puyol last week said he was going at the end of the season, because at least leaving Barcelona and possibly retiring, depending on how he feels, because physically thinks he just can't do it anymore. As you say, that rumour about Xavi going to the MLS just won't properly go away. So it could be that all three captains go at the end of the season. I mean, there's a very clear sense. Now, whether or not this is fair, I genuinely don't know, but watching them play, it's hard not to feel like this. I mean, there's a bit of a sense that the World Cup at the end of the season is such a big deal, particularly for Neymar and Messi, that maybe that's influencing the way they're playing. Of course, Messi's come back off an injury and seemed to be fit, but isn't quite there. And I think also some of the other problems they've had have really come back to bite them. The stuff around the Neymar transfer, the fact that the president's gone, the fact that there's a manager under pressure who came in very last minute because of Peter Villanova's illness, and the whole thing just feels like it is kind of falling apart a little bit. Now, I wouldn't rule out anything between now and then the season. I wouldn't rule out them getting things right and doing pretty well in the Champions League, but I think it's very, very difficult to see them winning the league now.
All right, so it does sound like a good time for Man City to be going there and trying to recoup this 2-0 first leg deficit.
Well, and this is the weird thing in all of this, in a way, isn't it? That we're talking about a Barcelona side that's been pretty poor throughout the year being the calendar year since 2014, and their results have been poor since then. But probably their best performance was away at Man City, where they controlled the game really well. And actually, apart from that kind of complete balls up against Valencia at home, they've not really looked under pressure at home. It's been away where they've been poor. So I suppose at home against Man City, with a 2-0 lead, those two away goals, they will probably feel like they're in a position where they really should go through. But yeah, I mean, if there was a time when emotionally perhaps it's not a bad time to play Barcelona when they're certainly not playing very well, that would be now. Just wonder though if two goals is too much of a lead.
Right. Okay. Well, what about Atletico Madrid, who are going to be taking on Milan at the Calderon? They had a victory over, who was it, Celta Vigo at the weekend.
Yeah.
With David Villa getting a brace.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I didn't expect Atletico to win this. Away, they'd lost, I think it's the last two away games they've been beaten in. They were beaten at Osasuna and beaten at Almeria. I think that's the last two. There might be one in between those games. They were going to Vigo against the Celta side, who I think are really quite a nice team, actually. Not a bad side at all, and they're starting to find their feet. They went there without Diego Godin, without Diego Costa, both of whom were suspended after the game against Real Madrid last weekend, and with the Milan game, what is it, 4 days later or 3 days later. And they actually weren't very good in the first half at all, but they really responded well in the second half. As you say, David Villa scored twice. I think that's 12 in the league this season. And Villa hasn't been a regular starter all season, but I think when you need someone to score goals, and if you get him in position, he doesn't waste chances very often. And I think they will feel not certain, but relatively confident about going through against Milan.
All right, well, it looks a scary prospect for Milan with David Villa and Diego Costa both available for Atletico.
Yeah, my guess, Jimbo, would be that the Atletico might not play both of them.
Right.
Okay. It wouldn't surprise me enormously if it was Raul Garcia off the striker, or possibly even Diego Ribas off the striker. But having played well at the weekend, maybe Villa's going to be in Simeone's mind.
All right, well, they're 1-0 up from the first leg, and Milan are coming off a second straight defeat. Sid, thanks a lot for that. We'll speak to you on Thursday, I hope.
My pleasure. Speak to you then.
Can I just run something up the flagpole? Xavi, is he too good for the MLS?
I tell you what...
I'll probably get pelters for this from
America. I don't know that you will, but we can ask Paolo Bandini that question, because he's going to be here in person on Thursday. The MLS having just got back underway, and he's uniquely well-placed to discuss that very, very telling question that you just raised, Barry. But back to the point I was about to make, Milan, how about that? Two straight defeats, current state off, honeymoon over, tick. And it was 1-0 away to Udinese, weren't in the best of form themselves. Lovely goal, though. With Toto Di Natale, who looks pretty much retired by now, but shuffled forward to tap in at the end of a nice kind of team move. But tell us why everyone's so excited about the Udinese goalkeeper, James.
Simone Scuffè. Yeah, he's 17.
Yes.
And he's got two Fs in his name.
Yes.
And everyone knows that if you've got two Fs in your name and you play golf for Italy, like Zoff and Buffon, you're going to be great.
And he is playing for Italy.
He's been invited to go to a training camp, which Prandelli has organised... to have a look at the youngsters ahead of Euro 2016. He's already looking ahead at that, even though he hasn't.
So suggestions are now that Prandelli might be staying around, right?
Exactly, yeah. He said he'll either sign on for another 4 years or he'll take a sabbatical.
Right.
Because I think the jobs he would aspire to, say Juventus or Milan, aren't available.
Mm.
Going back to Milan, I mean, to put this defeat into context, it was their 10th of the season in the league. They haven't lost that many at this stage since 97-98, when was the last time they didn't qualify for any European competition. But Clarence Seedorf took a calculated gamble, if you like, going into this by resting Kaká. He left Balotelli on the bench, brought him on later, left Trapatoni on the bench, brought him on later. But most of the team you'd expect to see play against Atletico were playing, because I think he believes that he needs to keep them fresh. I think when they did their initial scouting mission of Atletico played incredibly. They won 3-0 and they were blown away by their fitness. In fact, more than Diego Simeone, the coach, they were praising the fitness coach.
Mm.
So I think, yeah, that explains why they perhaps lost to Udinese. They were already taking their eye off the ball and had it on Madrid, because they don't really... I don't think Milan want to be in the Europa League next year. I mean, they see it as a bit of a waste. And the line in Gazzetta today, or one of the papers, is that if they get through to the quarterfinals, that'll bring in an extra 8 million in revenue, which is probably what they'd earn in a Europa League campaign anyway. So as long as they do that, so be it. They don't have to be in the Europa League.
Right. They won't be able to have midweek friendlies with Man United either.
No.
Every week if they're in the Europa League. Do you give them any chance against the...
I do, because I think... the first leg was a real turning point in their season. It was their best performance. They were really unlucky to lose. They hit the post, they hit the bar, they had other chances which, you know, they perhaps wasted, should have done better with. Penalty claim turned down. And yeah, their goal, Diego Costa, was in the 83rd minute, came completely against the run of play. So providing they can replicate that performance and repeat and take the chances that they didn't in the first leg, I think they could make it a lot closer. Certainly the closest of the ties remaining in this last 16 round.
All right, well, the other ties are PSG Bayer Leverkusen, and PSG beat Bayer Leverkusen at the Bay Arena 4-0. So that one looks pretty much done and dusted. Interesting to see Zlatan warming up for that one with another crazy back heel flick on. This one an assist for Lovetti at the weekend, which keeps them 8 points clear at the top of Ligue 1. And Arsenal are going to be at Bayern, where they won in the last 16 last time, no?
Yeah, I mean, if they get the result that they did last year, they take it to extra time. But I think perhaps Bayern will have learnt from that experience.
Bayern won 6-1 at the weekend, I see. Just their 16th consecutive victory.
Yeah, so just the 16 now.
Bayern have scored in every single game they've played since losing 2-0 to Arsenal on the 13th of March last year.
Wow. And it's the way they're scoring at the moment.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's very difficult to see them not scoring. And just on the strength of that stat alone, obviously. I mean, they've only scored one goal five times. So they've scored more than once in nearly every game.
Well, they've scored 11 in their last two games in the Bundesliga.
So it's a pretty tall order for Arsenal. Plus, I think only two teams in Champions League history have overcome a first-leg home defeat to turn the tie around.
Margin. Right. Really? Which two teams were they, Bear?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, Bayern, as Onan Barry was saying, awesome at the weekend. Awesome, and not just against any team. They were against Wolfsburg, a team with legitimate top four ambitions. But just like against Schalke the previous week, a top four side, they got absolutely destroyed by...
Well, I mean, they...
Five goals in 17 minutes from Bayern.
It was 1-1 until the 63rd minute, wasn't it, I think? And then they just decided to turn it on.
Wow. Extraordinary.
Did you see elsewhere in Germany, Aaron Hunt went down the penalty area, was given a penalty and then convinced the referee that it shouldn't have been a penalty against Nuremberg, and the referee changed his mind.
Yeah, it was very lovely to see.
According to Paolo Bandini, in the Knowledge in 2011, so this may have been superseded, but Inter beat by Munich to become just the second team in Champions League history to win a two-legged tie after losing the first leg at home. Ajax being the first in 1996.
Paolo Bandini has been very helpful today.
He is, he hasn't been here.
In France, we mentioned PSG, or Monaco saw Dimitar Berbatov get his first goal. He opened his account at Monaco and he didn't need a dog to do it either. That was the joke. But yeah, so they're 8 points behind, and Lille look pretty much set to wrap up third place. So that one all looks done. But there's a lot of talk that Michael Laudrup might be the new man at Monte Carlo, you know, at Monaco come next summer.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the summer there. I mean, obviously it's a bonkers project in many ways. It'll be interesting to see who leaves, and they've been Laudrup would be a bit of a reward for failure, wouldn't it? I mean, he's got this habit of sort of doing really well to start with, and then sort of second or third season struggling. But you know, you can see him fitting in there, can't you?
With his hair. He has good Monaco hair. You can kind of imagine him in a convertible driving up the coast.
Yeah,
I guess
the wayfarers on.
They're a newly promoted club, and I suppose if he takes them the League Cup there, you know, I mean, that would be a mark of success.
Now in Italy, Juve beat Fiorentina, which is always a big game, as the Gazzetta described it, the longest running argument in Italy, and they get to continue that argument on Thursday night. It was 1-0 on Sunday. Thursday night they meet in the Europa League. What is it, last 16? Lord knows.
You lose track, don't you?
Yeah. It's some stage, it's a knockout stage of the Europa League. They're still out there playing.
Yeah, they tweeted they had Fiorentina for lunch. It was a lunchtime kickoff, and now they're going to have them for dinner.
Right. Fiorentina, we should point out, before it sounds too, you know, pejorative, it's the name of a very big steak from Florence, a Fiorentina.
Yeah.
Mm. Nice.
But, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a massive slag. It's about a kilo of meat, isn't it? Yeah. Traditionally very, very rare. There you go. That's going to be a huge game on Thursday night.
Yeah, it should be, because, I mean, one of the reasons behind this rivalry is they had a UEFA Cup final when it was played over two legs. And the first leg, I think, was in Turin. Fans of Fiorentina were, I think, found to have, I don't know whether it would be thrown some flares or done something wrong. So the second leg, which was supposed to be played at the Artemio Franchi, ended up being played in Avellino, and Juventus won. So yeah, that again is a source of rivalry. So to meet in this competition again, there's relevancy for it, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Parma could be in the Europa League next year. They have gone 15 games now and beaten Roberto Donadoni with an absolutely brilliant run there. Amazing to see. They've had 5 clean sheets in the last 6. It just would be great to see Parma back in Europe, wouldn't it? Even if it's not that Parma.
Yeah, I think it's even more miraculous that it is this Parma, because they don't have players like Buffon, Cannavaro or Thuram anymore. So, yeah, considering what they've been through, you know, where they went to the brink of bankruptcy, they've been down to Serie B in the meantime. I think it's a great achievement, and it's again sort of reestablishes this idea that Roberto Donadoni is a very good coach. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he made a name for himself at Livorno, got the Italy job after Marcello Lippi decided to have some time away after he won the World Cup. And that was seen to be as a bit of a disappointment, because they got knocked out by Spain at Euro 2008, and he got sacked.
In retrospect, perhaps.
Yeah,
not that bad. No.
This Parma talk is stirring memories deep in the back of my mind. Is this you, Thomas Brolin, and a large block of cheese? Would that?
Yeah, those are. I mean, certainly there is all Parma related. Well, certainly two of them. Thomas Brolin.
Well, were you ever all together in one room?
Well, possibly. I don't know. Yeah, possibly. I can't. I wouldn't want to be the cheese if I
in
a room with Thomas. Yeah, but
there's an amazing photo of Fabio Cannavaro posted on his Twitter account recently. I think in Dubai, because that's where he's been playing. And Thomas Brolin had been out there, and the contrast in, let's say, you know, how these two people have been keeping themselves in recent years is staggering. You know, Cannavaro bronzed, six pack, looking very slick, and Brolin very much has let himself go.
He certainly has.
He'd let himself go long before he retired.
But those were heady days. Of course, it all turned out to be funded by very, very, very strange accounting, and led to various people going to jail and thousands of, hundreds of thousands possibly, of Italian pensioners losing all their hard-earned savings. So it was a very unfortunate end to that whole kind of L'Isola Felice Parma miracle. But nice to see the proper kind of blue-collar version turning up now. Similar story to Lazio, who equally had this run of European success funded on completely ludicrous, fraudulent business by Sergio Craniotti, who equally ended up in jail, and the club were teetering on the brink of going out of existence. Claudio Lotito came in, arranged this extraordinary 25-year mortgage on their unpaid taxes, but the fans have never taken to him, despite the fact that he's resurrected them and got them back into Europe.
That's the case. I mean, when he took over, they were so many hundred million in debt, and he said he interrupted a funeral. He rescued the club, it was still in a coma. They had to live in a sort of forced austerity for many years, and they're one of the best run clubs financially in Serie A at this moment in time. But that's because whenever they have a player who does well for them, they sell him at top price, and that's what happened in January. They sold Hernanez to Inter. That was seen as another show of a lack of ambition on his behalf.
So this weekend, the fans didn't turn up for their game at home to Atalanta, which they promptly lost 1-0.
Yes. So a fortnight ago at their last home game, it was one of the sell-out crowds at the Olimpico, and it wasn't because the team had been doing well. In fact, they'd lost to Ludogorets, the Bulgarian champions in the Europa League before that. They all turned up because they wanted to protest Lazio, and they held up these white pieces of paper saying, "Free Lazio." They called Lotito a dream thief. And then for their next home game, they organised to do
nasty,
completely the opposite, which was just not turn up.
All right.
And
Barry, that's what you've always been advocating all this time.
Absolutely.
Good to see it.
Yeah. But also, it's the classic thing, is that, you know, fans don't care which crook owns their club as long as they're spending money and not letting their striker go.
Yeah. Fancy. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what the sort of fallout is from that protest.
I doubt. I mean, they've tried everything. They've sent in bullets in the post. They've done everything.
Well, I mean, some of the ultras were involved in, I think it's a few years ago now, when Giorgio Chinaglia ended up fronting a consortium that was supposedly from Hungary.
A Hungarian pharmaceutical giant, which turned out to be...
Which was later found to be, I think, Camorra, so Neapolitan mafia money, and they were trying to launder it back into the country by buying Lazio. So, but, yeah, by standing up and saying no to that, I think... Again, Lazio fans owe Lotito. I mean, again, that was a case of them wanting this idol, this icon of Lazio-ness, Lazialità, back in Chinaglia, which, you know, he doesn't seem to stand. He seems to stand for everything that's against that.
The Glazers don't know they're born, basically, do they? You know, if you a few yellow and green scarves and refusal to buy burgers at the stadium doesn't really compare.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Giorgio Chinaglia, of course, the Swansea-born Italy and Lazio legend who won the title.
Yeah,
with
in
that
the 70s,
crazy Lazio side, who then went round holding up jewellers at gunpoint and getting shot for their troubles and stuff like that. Yeah, crazy days. Anyway, he's now passed on. I tell you what, that's it for Europe. But a quick mention for the Championship. One or two people suggesting that we weren't exactly on the money with our Championship roundup on Thursday. So here goes. With a little update on that. Leaders Leicester are playing on Tuesday, so it was a big chance for the chasing pack to close the gap. Did they take it?
I don't know.
All right, I'll
Burnley
tell you.
Did.
Yeah.
They beat Blackburn for the first time in 2 million years or something.
Indeed, they did. Strengthen their grip on second place.
More protests from the Blackburn fans. They're still doing flypasts with planes and releasing chickens on the
pitch. Maybe they should try not going to the match, as Lazio fans did.
Well, maybe so, actually. Yeah. A third place Derby lost at home to Millwall, and fourth place QPR got their first win in six attempts, beating Birmingham 2-0. It was a bad weekend all round for East Midland clubs, with Forest losing away to Barnsley, and that win meant the Terriers climbed off the bottom of the Championship, swapping places with Charlton.
Interesting. Morrison scored twice, didn't he, for QPR, which I think be interesting to see. Yes, he did. Be interesting to see how he gets on. Joe Barton was saying that he was prepared to be his mentor on Twitter, which
who he was talking about.
If you want a mentor, I'm sure you're not sure you'd choose Joe Barton.
Well, perhaps, you know.
Joe Barton has some chums in this podcast.
No, I'm just saying. You know, if it's a man who's faced issues and dealt with them.
True.
Then, maybe that's not as crazy as it sounds. Bolton with a 5-1 win away at Leeds.
Yeah, the least said about that, the better, thank you.
All right.
Well, desperate. Talking of clubs that never seem to be able to catch a break, I mean, Leeds lurch from
one
ownership crisis.
Well, they might not be bought by Massimo Cellino, so
indeed,
that's something.
That might be something, indeed. Yeah.
Also, Charlton, you mentioned their bottom, but they do have three games in hand and are only 3 points from, or 4 points from safety, so...
Mm.
But they were very poor against Sheffield United. They just look so listless and rudderless.
And Powell's a very likeable man, isn't he? I mean, he's got a lot of fans, but, you know, you just wonder how they'll react now to that cup defeat, you know. I fear for them.
All right. That's it for part two, listeners. Still to come, the Premier League action from Saturday. Premier League then, friends. Everyone rustling their papers to the appropriate point. Have a look at that league table. A league table which features Crystal Palace in 16th place now, but with a game in hand after their defeat at home to Southampton. They are 2 points off the drop in the bottom three. Well, first off, West Brom are just outside the relegation zone, only on goal difference, after they got thoroughly thumped at home to Man United. Man United, it was good news more or less all round, with the possible exception of Robin Van Persie in this game. Is that right?
Exactly. Still this Robin Van Persie puzzle. And it's interesting, the number of voices who seem to be tentatively suggesting he should be, that Moyes should actually sell him this summer now, which, you know, would have been unthinkable.
Is Robin Van Persie one of those voices?
Probably. I'm sure. I'm almost certain that he is, along with his agent, I'm sure, yeah.
You should sell him.
But he did exactly cover himself in glory, did he? And there was only... on the verge of getting himself sent off, then got hauled off, and Rooney completed twice as many passes with Welbeck in half the time on the pitch that he did with Van Persie.
Because that's been one of those long-running memes, the fact that Rooney and Van Persie have passed between each other about 8 times in 6 games and they've all been from kickoff.
Yeah. Well, Van Persie seems to be showing a bit of petulance lately, and that combined with the fact that
completely out of character,
you can no longer get a full season out of him after, you know, a run of a couple of seasons where he was fit all the time, would suggest you possibly would be better off without him. Cash him in and bring in someone else.
Juventus have been talked about, haven't they? Has been potentially interested.
Well, they're well stocked for that kind of thing.
I mean, they did want him.
Chat or Inter.
They did want him there. Was it the summer he went to United? There was an offer on the table for him then. But I think they've in some respects since moved on in signing Tevez and Fernando Llorente. Perhaps
return of Fellaini though. Lots of people getting very excited about him.
Yeah, I mean, people weren't getting very excited about him before he got injured. But I mean, I think there's still a chance he could come good for Moyes. I mean, I think the logic behind signing him was sound. It was just the fact that he was the only one that meant that he was attracted all this derision, and he was arguably played out of position during those first few months at United.
Which position did he play in this game?
And became a sort of lightning rod for criticism, didn't he? Played a bit further up the pitch than he was being used. He's not a holding midfielder, is he? You know,
indeed not.
I think although the result was emphatic, it came against the West Brom side that yet to get a win under Pepe Mel.
And
I think Moyes and some of his players afterwards were sort of keen to make a lot of how they performed. You know, they seemed to attack better, come together better. But
they did this before the Olympiacos game as well, didn't they? Winning at Crystal Palace and then promptly put in one of their worst performances of the season in the Champions League.
Their best run of form sort of before Christmas going into that was against teams you'd expect them to usually wipe the floor.
They're games they should win, aren't they? Yeah. You know? But I found West Brom intriguing because obviously, you know, they just had this disastrous season for what's usually a very well-run club. It's this, you know, fairly, to me, a nonsensical decision to get rid of Clark when they were 16th at the time, and you know, nothing they've done since has given you any confidence they're going to survive.
And they put a Spaniard in the works in a very real sense. So you have them doomed
for me, yeah.
And do you also have Fulham down now after their loss away to Cardiff?
Yeah, I mean, that was, you put that in a similar category, wouldn't you? You know, kind of I suppose they showed some fight in levelling, but then thereafter they looked fairly spineless.
It's still only 4 points away from safety with 9 games.
Yeah, but they're so bad. I mean, perhaps Felix Magath will have some sort of influence. You know, he hasn't had long there yet, but he came out with some very strange comments after the game. He sort of seemed to suggest that he thinks they're doomed. He said they have to win all their home games, which, you know, could be pretty tricky considering they've Everton at home, Norwich, Hull, Crystal Palace. And he said that the reason Cardiff won is because they're more used to battling against relegation, which Cardiff haven't had a relegation scrap for over 8 years, which would suggest his research before taking the job may not have been all it should have been.
Fulham, of course, have, and got themselves out with Roy Hodgson at the helm of a worse situation, arguably. I think they were 8 points from safety when he managed to turn things around.
But I just don't think there's any sign of this time around. And whereas, as you say, Hull give every impression of having bought well, Fulham give every impression of having bought incredibly badly.
We finally got to
see
Mitroglou, and it wasn't pretty.
It wasn't really, no. I mean, in some ways, you feel a bit sorry for him because he's been chucked in there with no, you know, previous Premier League experience, expected to score the goals to keep them up. And, you know, on first showing, there's no sign of him doing that.
He's abandoned the Champions League campaign for this.
Yeah.
He could have been a part of that victory over United for Olympiacos. But
wow.
Now he's there.
Well, that's poignant, isn't it? On a similar note, Ricky van Wolfswinkel came back for Norwich.
Yes,
back. Paul Doyle pointing out he cost £8.5 million and has scored so far one goal, which is £8.5 million per goal. That goal came with his very first shot for the club. Since then, nothing in 20 appearances.
He should have basically scored that goal, wheeled away in celebration, gone down the tunnel into his car, driven off into the sunset.
All right.
He'd have been a hero.
A 1-1 draw for Norwich this weekend, which means that they too are not out of trouble. 4 points above the relegation zone, but teams down there have games in hand on them. West Brom have a game in hand on them. Sunderland have 3.
I think the main thing you can conclude is that some terrible, terrible, terrible football teams are going to stay in the Premier League this season.
Good. Keep it lively.
Yeah.
Chelsea Spurs.
Go on, Owen.
Well, actually, you know, all for all Sherwood's kind of implosion at the end, in which he sort of, you know, took aim at everybody, including and most of all his own players, for sort of lack of effort and lack of heart. Actually, they were sort of in the game for an hour, and it was really, you know, kind of that penalty decision of sending off that killed it for Spurs. Obviously, they were 1-0 down by that
point. Well, yeah, the 1-0 as well, from extraordinary behaviour from Vertonghen. What was he trying to do?
It was a bizarre series of individual errors, and it was a sort of controversial refereeing decision that lost the game for them. I mean, it didn't feel like a 4-0 thrashing, but
right.
I think Sherwood's frustration, as Dave Heitner points out in his match report today, also stems from the fact that he's kind of twisting in the wind, really. He's been given no assurances over his future at the end of the season. He's frustrated with his players. He's frustrated with Levy, who's not really given him any sense of what's going to happen at the end of the season, although everyone suspects that Van Gaal will come in. And I think it just feels like a club in constant flux. I mean, and I think Levy's got some questions to answer. I mean, I remember writing a piece when AVB went, which sort of said that Levy always seems to get away scot-free, and that now I think a lot of fans will start thinking, hold on a minute, you know, is this man a business genius who's running the club fantastically well, or has he in fact made a series of decisions that haven't played out particularly well, and Chelsea just sort of grind their way on remorselessly, and Mourinho looks like he's really enjoying himself again, doesn't he, basically, you know, kind of talking up the chance of Manchester City and Liverpool, while at the same time, you know, furiously denying that Chelsea have any chance of winning the league, despite being several points clear.
What did you make of Sherwood's decision to announce to the world that there's a lack of characters, too many of his players are too nice to each other, we need to show some guts and not be someone's mate all the time, it hurts me, as he said?
Well, I think it's quite entertaining and refreshing to hear a manager speak out like that, but I don't think he's going to do himself any favours. He sounded to me like a bloke who knows he's going to be out of a job in summer, and you know, he's just reached the end of his tether, I suppose. I like Sherwood. He seems like a real good guy, you know, a nice fella to have a few pints with, but I think he's a bit out of his depth, but I don't think he deserves all the criticism for some of the hidings Spurs have shipped.
But he has signings in the summer, you know. Yeah, kind of, they spent 100 million quid on players who not one of which started on Saturday,
which is remarkable.
I think three or four of them were injured.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah,
and Paulinho coming back off injury, so perhaps he would have started it, wasn't he?
Yes,
he
came off. Yeah.
But I think that again, that's on Levy, because you bring in a director of sport who plans his recruitment around the manager he has at the time. Levy then sacks the manager, promotes someone who didn't, particularly in his early games.
Surely the whole point of a director of football is that you don't plan your acquisitions around whoever the manager is. You have a club policy, and which, as you say, is Levy's fault. And then whoever the manager comes in has to kind of toe the line of the club policy.
I mean, this was a team that was playing, you know, 4-2-3-1. Last year, you know, they had, you know, Bale and Lennon on either flank, and if that didn't work, then all they had was Sigurdsson and Dempsey. So, I mean, they bring in Chadli, they bring in Lamella. Yeah, they tried to bolster that midfield because Sandro often out injured, so they bring in Paulinho, etc. So I thought, personally, a lot of the recruitment that they did was sensible. But they then, you know, they then sacked AVB, and, you know, I think Sherwood hasn't really put a lot of faith in the signings. That might be because, you know, they're in a situation where they have to win now. And these players, none of them had Premier League experience beforehand. There's probably going to be an adjustment period there, naturally. Lamella, who was their club record signing, has struggled in that respect, but also with injury. But yeah, I do think, you know, when it came to sacking AVB and bringing someone like Sherwood in, who, as a development manager, brought in players like Bentaleb, etc., wanted to show what he could do. Yeah, that, again, just wrote off almost all of that recruitment.
It does show the ridiculously high stakes at the moment, though, when you're still talking about a club that's, you know, fifth in the league and 4 points off a Champions League place and five clear of the team in sixth, which is Man United. So, I mean, kind of, I agree with absolutely all the criticism. I think, you know, a lot of it is down to the fact there's no sort of single voice that's sort of consistently saying the same thing at White Hart Lane. They sort of flip-flop from one thing to the other. But it's extraordinary, really, that a club that's sitting fifth has got, you know, fans tearing their hair out and, you know, questions over the manager at the end of the season.
Well, I think this season was the big opportunity for someone new to break into the top four. And Liverpool have taken it. And Spurs haven't. So that would probably explain a lot of the frustration.
And again, Liverpool are an example of, yeah, they had a player who agitated a lot more than Gareth Bale to leave in Luis Suarez, and they put their foot down, kept him. You know, perhaps they could have done that, you know, got another year out of Gareth Bale.
I thought those comments from Henry were really interesting. Yeah. Well, he basically said, yeah, there was a release clause and we just ignored it because players ignore their contracts, so we did too. And, you know, you just wonder how many other clubs are now looking at that and thinking...
Well, Dinipro, of course, did that with Conor Plianka, with Liverpool. Chelsea, anyway, 7 points clear of Liverpool at the top, nine of Man City. And this, in terms of difficult games left in their season, and difficult in inverted commas, because, of course, there's no easy games at this level, and that, they've still got Arsenal at home and Liverpool away, but make a little space in the trophy cabinet. Eowyn.
Well,
come on.
No, I still think Man City are definitely still in it.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at their squad and you look at the way they've played for large parts of the season, but it has got that Chelsea have got a sort of relentless feel to them. It does feel a bit like those Mourinho teams of old when they're not playing outstandingly well, certainly not for whole matches, but they do enough in every game, and with Hazard they've got the man who can kind of unlock any defence, really.
Four goals conceded by them since December.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Four. And when you consider, you know, everybody was writing off John Terry, you know, a year, 18 months ago, and he's been the mainstay of that defence this season, and, you know, you can see why, in football terms, people are talking about the World Cup and Terry and Cahill, but, you know, you can understand why, for every other reason, Hodgson's closed the door on that.
And what other reasons are there?
Well, all the water under the bridge.
Oh, all that stuff, right, okay. All right.
All that business.
All that unpleasantness. Now, hey, Samuel Eto'o. Two great goal celebrations. Maybe there were more, but certainly two. One was our friend at Hull.
David Myler.
Yeah, thank you very much. The corner flag.
Head-butting the corner flag. And Samuel Eto'o hobbling over to the corner flag and using it as a walking stick.
And he's 33
he's
today,
old.
Apparently.
He is indeed, yeah.
Oh, stop with your apparently. He's just...
Yeah. Well, if you're good enough, you're old enough. It doesn't matter what your age you are. And he scored twice, didn't he?
He did.
I think sometimes there's been criticism of him, but I think one of the reasons why you see Hazard and Oscar scoring so many goals is because of a lot of the work that Eto'o does. So.
Clearly he's not the player he was, but he's still scored important goals this year, and, you know, and particularly at home. You know, he's not really doing it away, but in those games, particularly against Manchester United.
Unlike Olivier Giroud.
Indeed.
Right. Well, on that note, we'll come to the end of today's very exciting pre-Champions League and post-FA Cup quarter-final football weekly. Many thanks to Barry, to James and to Owen and producer Ben. Cheerio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.